Hallo zusammen, hier ist Erik. Bevor es mit der Folge losgeht, ein rascher Hinweis in eigener Sache. Wenn ihr unsere Arbeit schätzt, und zwar ob nun den Weltwach-Podcast oder auch unsere anderen Shows, Reiseflops, Tierisch oder auch die Weltwach-Klangreise, und wenn ihr uns unterstützen möchtet oder wenn ihr auch einfach nicht genug Weltwach bekommen könnt, für all diese Fälle habe ich gute Nachrichten für euch. Und ihr ahnt es vielleicht schon, ich spreche vom Weltwach Supporters Club. Als Mitglied des Weltwach Supporters Clubs erhaltet ihr Zugriff auf die regulären Folgen des Weltwach Podcasts, und zwar ohne Werbung unserer Sponsoren. Und ihr erhaltet ab dem zweiten Paket Zugriff auf sämtliche Folgen von mittlerweile ganzen 3 exklusiven Showformaten. Erstens der Klassiker Weltwach Plus. Mittlerweile haben wir da viele Dutzend Folgen mit Weltwachfreunden wie Christine Thürmer, Andreas Altmann, Michael Martin und so weiter, aber auch mit vielen Gästen, die ihr noch nicht aus der regulären Show kennt. Das zweite Exklusivformat ist Weltwach Extrem. Hier erzählen unsere Gäste von ihren denkwürdigsten, das heißt also schönsten, gefährlichsten, furchtbarsten und so weiter, Momenten unterwegs. Mehrere Supporter haben uns auch schon gemailt, dass das definitiv ihr neues Lieblings-Weltwach-Format ist. Das freut mich natürlich sehr. Und schließlich unser drittes Exklusivformat, Weltwach Backstage. Hier geben wir vom Weltwach-Team euch einen Einblick hinter die Kulissen unserer Arbeit. Alle Infos zur Mitgliedschaft findet ihr auf weltwach.de unter Supporters Club. Dort erklären wir, wie ihr über die Plattform Steady eine Mitgliedschaft abschließen könnt und wie ihr Zugriff auf euren exklusiven Supporter-Podcast-Feed erhaltet, mit dem ihr dann die werbefreien und auch die Bonusfolgen hören könnt. Und wenn ihr zum Podcast hören Spotify benutzt, dann könnt ihr auch gern einfach in der Spotify-App nach Weltwach Supporters Club suchen und dort direkt eine Mitgliedschaft abschließen. Ihr werdet dann zu Steady weitergeleitet. Ist ganz einfach. All das gibt es, wie gesagt, übersichtlich auf weltwach.de unter Supporters Club. Wir danken allen Unterstützerinnen und Unterstützern von Herzen. Ihr tragt mit dazu bei, unsere Arbeit zu ermöglichen. Und wir werden uns weiterhin darum bemühen, euch im Gegenzug fantastische, exklusive Zusatzinhalte anzubieten. Für noch mehr Weltwach, noch mehr Abenteuer, noch mehr Reiselust und noch mehr Wissen über unseren faszinierenden Planeten. Dankeschön.
To be able to spend so much time by myself making my way across this most wondrous of places. You know, I still pinch myself at the fact that I had the opportunity to do that. So much of my time in Antarctica has been that strange mix of those two things, terror and euphoria all at the same time. So things that I'm interested in are things that scare me.
Grenzgänger und leidenschaftliche Weltenwanderer nehmen uns mit auf ihre Streifzüge und bieten Einblicke in ferne Orte und faszinierende Kulturen. Mit offenen Augen ins Abenteuer. Das ist der Weltwach-Podcast mit Erik Lorenz.
Ich denke an das erste Mal zurück, als ich einen richtigen Blick auf die Antarktis werfen konnte. Die Einfachheit, die Schönheit und die Vollkommenheit des Ganzen hatten etwas an sich, das mich dazu brachte, alles einsammeln und irgendwie in mich aufnehmen zu wollen. Das ist ein Zitat unseres Gastes dieser Folge, der Polarforscherin, Autorin, Rednerin und Expeditionsleiterin Felicity Aston. Und genau das hat sie auch getan. Sie hat die Antarktis und die Polarregion insgesamt in sich selbst aufgenommen. Sie verbrachte durchgehend 2,5 Jahre, einschließlich 2 aufeinanderfolgender Winter, in einer Forschungsstation auf der antarktischen Halbinsel. Und diese ersten Erfahrungen in der Antarktis führten dann zu zahlreichen Expeditionen an entlegene Orte in der ganzen Welt, vor allem aber wiederum in die Polarregion. Sie führte zum Beispiel internationale Teams zum Nord- und Südpol. Sie arbeitete auf einem nuklearbetriebenen Eisbrecher am Nordpol, leitete die erste britische Frauendurchquerung Grönlands, fuhr auf Skiern einen gefrorenen Fluss in Sibirien entlang, überquerte das Wintereis des Baikalsees, fuhr Rennen in der kanadischen Arktis, fuhr 35.000 Kilometer durch Eurasien zum kältesten bewohnten Ort der Welt Und zwar, mir geht schon die Luft langsam aus, es ist eine Menge, wie ihr seht. Und 2012 war sie dann die erste Frau, die die Antarktis allein auf Skiern durchquerte. Und das war eine Reise von 1744 Kilometern, für die sie 59 Tage benötigte. Damit stellte sie einen Weltrekord auf und war eben nicht nur die erste Frau, die diese Tour gemeistert hat, sondern auch der erste Mensch überhaupt, also egal ob männlich oder weiblich, der dies allein und mit eigener Muskelkraft geschafft hat, also ohne Kiteschirme oder Maschinen irgendwelcher Art. Für all diese Leistungen wurde Felicity zum Fellow der Royal Geographic Society in London und des Explorers Club in New York gewählt, beides sehr prestigeträchtige Organisationen, und sie hat viele weitere Auszeichnungen erhalten und unter anderem übrigens auch über ihre Erfahrungen etliche Bücher geschrieben. Ich glaube, es sind 4 Stück an der Zahl, könnt ihr gerne mal nachschlagen. In dieser Folge spreche ich mit ihr über die Herausforderungen, denen sie sich während ihrer Antarktis-Überquerung stellen musste, und natürlich auch über die Schönheit dieses Erdteils. Viel Spaß bei unserem Gespräch, das wir, falls ich es noch nicht erwähnt habe, in Englisch geführt haben. Also, ich hoffe, ihr Englisch ist sehr gut, britisches Englisch, gut zu verstehen. Ich hoffe, ihr kommt damit klar und ich wünsche euch damit viel Spaß. Bitteschön. Hi Felicity, welcome to our show and yeah, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me.
I would like to start our conversation by reading a text of yours, and it's a pretty short text. To be more precise, it's a tweet, and it's pretty old by now. It's almost a decade old. It's from January 2012, and you wrote the following in that tweet. Woke up to find everything sore from my toes to my brain. Even my thoughts ache. So, yeah, as we can hear, at the moment you wrote that tweet, you were obviously not feeling all that well. I would like to go into the situation in a bit more detail in a moment. But first, I would be interested, where were you in this situation? And just in general terms, what were you doing there?
I remember it very well. I woke up in a small tent that wasn't wider than my outstretched arms and wasn't much longer than the length of my body lying down in my sleeping bag. And I woke up and I could hear the noise of the wind outside. And even though I couldn't see it, I could picture exactly the landscape that was outside that tent. It was the vast plain of the Central Antarctic Plateau. So I was coming towards the end of a expedition to ski across the landmass of Antarctica by myself. So by January, I had already been alone and on the move for about 6 weeks. And it was that aloneness that had a bigger impact on me than perhaps the kilometers that I covered by that point.
Yeah, and I would like to talk about that very aloneness, because when you talk about that expedition, that is one of the most impressive ways you talk about it, the way you describe what this extreme aloneness actually feels like, and a kind of aloneness and solitude that I think very few of us ever experienced. But maybe first, let's give our listeners a little bit of context. I'm sure it's a long story, but let's give it a try to just give us a glimpse. Why did you set your mind on crossing Antarctica? Why did you set yourself such a challenge?
Yeah, it's a bit like when people call celebrities an overnight success. And, you know, that term is meaningless because probably they've spent a decade or more, you know, slowly building up their expertise and their confidence until finally they get that breakthrough moment. And it's a bit the same with polar expeditions. You know, I didn't wake up one morning and go, I know I'm going to ski across Antarctica by myself. And by the time that I'd set out on that expedition, I'd had more than a decade of taking part in and organizing and leading different polar expeditions to different cold places around the world. So it was a sort of gradual progression. And each of the expeditions that I put together were more challenging in some way to the last, at least in the way I saw it. And that wasn't necessarily in terms of the number of days or the number of kilometers. So for example, you know, one of my first independent expeditions that I put together was a ski crossing of Greenland. And it was my very first expedition that I was in the role of leader as well. So that for me was really personally challenging because I was taking on a lot more responsibility.
Did that change, did that new role as a leader significantly change how you perceived being in a landscape like Greenland, this added responsibility? Or was it something that you got used to after 1 or 2 days?
No, for sure. I mean, I think anyone who's ever suddenly taken responsibility for a project would agree with me that it changes your perspective on so many different levels. And I remember quite clearly the first day of that particular expedition. We were gaining altitude on a glacier, and it was really rough. It was just like a jumble of ice blocks. And I sort of paused for a second. I looked up and I watched these three women who had put their confidence in me to lead them on this expedition, and they were sort of in a real jam on this in all this ice, and it all looked really hopeless and pretty grim. And I remember feeling the weight of that responsibility very heavily then. I mean, all of my expeditions, you know, I'm quite a, you know, we did it as a team. You know, I wasn't a particularly dictatorial leader, but you know, ultimately, I was responsible for them and for the success of the expedition. So there were several moments in that expedition where I felt that very heavily.
And there's not a lot of room for serious error, right? So that makes every big decision probably pretty heavy.
You're totally wrong. For that expedition, we made every mistake. Okay. I mean, I look back on that now as a veteran of more than 20 years of putting together expeditions. And that trip leaves me breathless when I think back to some of the decisions that we made and how naive they were. I mean, we went out there with such little idea. And the dangerous thing was that we had no idea how much we didn't know. That was the dangerous thing. And we made every mistake. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got our rations wrong. We were skeletal by the time we got back. We chose the wrong boots. So we had really terrible sort of cold injuries on our feet. We were very lucky, I think, to get away with doing that expedition successfully. And yet it's one of the expeditions I'm most proud of, because we put in a really good performance. You know, we crossed the Greenland ice sheet in 16 days. And then after a 2-day break, we turned around and crossed it back to our start point in 14 days. Wow. I mean, you know, even now there are not many teams out there that are doing that. But we had no idea how hard we were pushing ourselves, because we had nobody with which to measure ourselves against. So, we learned a lot of lessons. But it's interesting that coming back from that expedition, rather than feeling defeated by all the mistakes we'd made, it was a real motivation for me. You know, I wanted to put those mistakes into action, those lessons that we'd learned. I wanted to use them so that hadn't been a waste. And so that's what I did. I started putting together other expeditions. And going back to what I was saying before, you know, each one was more challenging than last. So the next expedition after that, I put together a completely novice team. So people who'd done nothing like this before, you know, places like Ghana in West Africa and Jamaica in the Caribbean and Cyprus in the Mediterranean, places that you don't associate with polar exploration particularly. But, you know, and then eventually we fast forward to the point where I started to get curious about what it would feel like to be in a polar environment without that motivation of having a team around you, you know, particularly when you're in a leadership role. You know, largely you have little choice but to put the best version of yourself forward every day, because, you know, you can't sit in that tent in the morning, you know, sticking your head back into your sleeping bag going, oh, I'm not getting up today, or I'm too tired, or bursting into tears and saying it's all going wrong, because people would lose confidence in you and your project would fall apart. So, you know, you've got no choice but to put best foot forward every day as best you can. And so I was curious, you know, okay, well, if I take that motivation away, you know, am I still as self-disciplined? Am I still as determined and resilient? Or, you know, does something else happen? And so that was really the founding question that led me to go and try and cross Antarctica by myself.
And I suppose what you just told us about this expedition with all these mishaps and mistakes, I mean, this shows that in some sense you were successful, right? Because you said you always looked for the next expedition to be really challenging for you, meaning taking you out, to use a buzzword, taking you out of your comfort zone and putting you in a situation where you don't really exactly know what to do and how big the challenge actually will be and which kind of challenge will be put to you exactly. So the fact that you made all these mistakes probably shows that it was a real challenge and probably also explains why you girls were so happy afterwards that you actually made it, because you did something that maybe you were not even really ready for yet.
Well, exactly. I mean, I often say if the idea of your expedition to come isn't an idea that wakes you up in the middle of the night with sweat on your brow, then your ambition isn't high enough. You know, you're not pushing yourself far enough. But I say that with a caveat. You know, I mean, whatever challenge means to you is great. You know, there are some people that you don't want to have that feeling, that stress, but you know, I'm part of that, I guess you could call them perverse minority of the population where, you know, I'm infinitely interested in, well, how far can I push this? And, you know, I've got zero interest whatsoever in doing the same thing over and over again. If I'm setting out to make a journey and I know absolutely 100% that I'm going to make this journey with no mishaps whatsoever, you know, I that's not an expedition to me. That's certainly not exploration or my understanding of exploration or adventure. So, you know, things that I'm interested in are things that scare me.
Which is interesting, because I think that doesn't mean that you try to consciously provoke these mishaps, right? That's, I think, a fine line to walk when planning an expedition, which is that you want it to be challenging, you want to go into the unknown, but if you are a responsible person, which I know that you are, I know that you also plan a lot and you prepare a lot, even though maybe your little story didn't seem like this, but of course it was also a summed up version. But I know that for your expeditions, not only weeks of physical training, but months and sometimes years of preparation go into an expedition like that, right? So it's really a fine line to find this sweet spot between being really challenged, but also still knowing what you do and be responsible towards others, but also towards yourself.
Yeah, I think you've got it exactly right. I mean, I have never gone out on an expedition when I haven't believed 100% that, you know, we've thought through every possible permutation of eventuality and done our best to minimize those risks. But it is getting that balance right between understanding the risks you are taking and trying to minimize them as much as possible. So you're right. It's almost a paradox that, you know, you plan so that nothing will go wrong, but you're not surprised when things do go wrong. It's almost an inevitability. Yes. But you know, that's kind of what where the experience and the confidence comes in. You know, the more of these expeditions that you do, the more you find the ability when things go catastrophically wrong that you feel like, oh, you know, I've seen this before, or at least I know where to start in trying to find the solution, rather than being instantly defeated by those problems and obstacles.
This reminds me a little bit of a conversation I had with mountaineer Reinhold Messner, who, of course, at least in a German-speaking world, is one of the grandfathers of the archetype of adventurer. And he always likes to say for him, an adventure is to go out to a place where you could die and to do that purposefully, but with, of course, the full intention of not dying. I mean, it doesn't have to be always about life and death, of course. That's what you said with regard to the caveat. Everybody's adventure can be different and on a different scale. But this paradox between going out to face dangers, but not necessarily doing it as a danger freak, but actually to go out there to maybe deconstruct these dangers. And through preparation and experience and talent and skill and whatever, turn it into something that is actually hopefully quite manageable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remain Reinhold Messner, he's a hero to everybody, but you know, I remain quite sanguine, I guess, maybe even skeptical in the face of the old traditional, quite bullish language of adventure. You know, why do you climb that mountain? Because it's there and I could die on this mountain and I want to die on this mountain. I couldn't die anywhere else. You know, yeah. I find all that. I wonder if in that, I had a wonderful conversation with a very young mountain climber who had faced death on Everest. He'd wandered off the route, got really stuck and found himself sat somewhere. Mm-hmm. And he spent a night on Everest believing that, you know, his time was up. He was going to sit there and die. And it was so fascinating to hear him talk through the phases of anger and regret and sadness and frustration and all those emotions that he went through while sat on that mountain. And, you know, and it just really, I guess, stuck with me because I thought none of us know how we're going to feel in that moment, you know, if it came to it. And, you know, so all this kind of bullish language before, I think, rings a bit hollow with me. And, yeah. You know, I experienced this a bit myself. There was a very well-respected polar explorer who died during an expedition a handful of years ago. And I think, you know, he was so well experienced. He was so well regarded. He knew what he was doing, absolutely. And yet still he died as a result of his expedition. And I think as a result of that, it brought into focus for me quite what I was risking when I was going out and doing these expeditions. And in fact, just in this past year, another polar veteran, very highly thought of, lost his life in Greenland. And it's another moment you sort of feel the whole kind of polar community take a sort of collective pause because it reminds you that it doesn't matter how much experience you've got. It doesn't matter how famous you are. You know, these places still have the potential to take your life. And, you know, as you were saying before, you know, we all go out there with supreme confidence that we've done our planning, we've done our training, we're not going out there intending to die. And yet, you know, there are constant reminders that that is exactly what can happen. And I think, you know, at different times in your life, you're willing to risk that more, you know, when you don't have dependents, for example, you know, what you decide to do largely affects only you. But then later in your life, maybe when you have people that are dependent on you and you're only too aware what your death, what impact that would have on those people that are dependent on you, you feel about it differently. So yeah, I'm certainly not prescribing to this kind of heroic attitude of years gone by. You know, yeah. I'm not a thrill seeker. I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I'm a spreadsheet person. I'm a what if person. I'm a let's do the risk assessment person, which is all very boring, but to me, very essential.
Yeah, a spreadsheet person is a good way to put it because that's a big part of an expedition like that, right? Really just getting down the nitty-gritty to be ready for this challenge that you choose for each and every expedition. And if we come back to the Trans-Antarctic crossing, we were talking about the different challenges that you chose for your different expeditions. And you already hinted at that one important aspect for that project was to find out how you will deal with this solitude in terms of discipline, for example, and routine and all these things that are so important on a project like that. Was that really the main focus, like the one challenge that you were excited by to find out more about? Because being alone in Antarctica, I would suppose, can pose all kinds of different challenges. It can be a physical challenge. It can be, of course, if you get tired and you get stuck or you break a leg, there's nobody else who can help you. So there is this aspect maybe of increased danger, I don't know. But of course, there's also the question of the strength of your own mind and how you are able to deal with this vastness that surrounds you and with the knowledge that nobody else is there to talk to or to confide in. Like, what was the appeal, the main appeal and main goal for you with regard to that project?
Yeah, and you're right that curiosity about how I would respond to being in that situation, to being totally responsible for myself. You know, would I react in the way that I expected? Would I live up to those wonderful examples of the past, you know, those heroic characters that you read about, or would I crumble in the face of that? But I think for me, actually, the number one motivation that came above any of that was Antarctica itself. Mm-hmm. You know, I just remember flying to the start point of my expedition and getting to fly over the Transantarctic Mountains and to fly over the whole continent. And, you know, it just felt like such an amazing privilege to have the opportunity to see an entire cross-section of this most incredible of continents. And I'm aware as I'm saying this that I run the risk of sounding totally precocious, sort of pretentious, but I don't mean it to come across like that. I mean, Antarctica is a place that just fills me with wonder as it does so many others. And to be able to spend so much time by myself making my way across this most wondrous of places, you know, I still pinch myself at the fact that I had the opportunity to do that. And I'm continually grateful for that even now. You know, I mean, there were many moments during that journey where I would be skiing, likely as not, through a total whiteout. And whiteout is a term that is thrown around very, you know, regularly in normal life. But when you've experienced a real whiteout, you know, an Antarctic whiteout, and it doesn't just last for days, it can last for a week or more, you know, it's really something else. And, you know, I remember skiing through a really sort of bad whiteout with a big blizzard. And then I sort of suddenly got this view into the distance and a glimpse of blue sky. And, you know, one half of my brain, this is simultaneously, one half of my brain was going, you know, in total sheer terror, like, you know, I'm out here in the middle of this vastness by myself in a storm, in this brutal cold. You know, I was just going into a mental tailspin. And yet the other half of my brain at the very same time was going, wow, look at this. You know, you're skiing through an Antarctic blizzard, just like you read about your heroes doing, you know, a century ago. It was one at the same time, just euphoria and absolute terror. And so much of my time in Antarctica has been that strange mix of those two things, terror and euphoria, all at the same time. So yeah, so I would say it was Antarctica first and foremost that was the inspiration for that trip.
What you just said already answers that in part, but I will give it a try anyway. You said Antarctica is such a wonderful place that makes you wonder, that is just fascinating and breathtaking. It's so vast and empty and amazing. And I've heard many people say that. Can you explain what it is about Antarctica that creates this impact? Because for somebody who hasn't been there, you might say, yeah, well, I see it's a lot of ice and snow, but actually there's nothing there. But if you talk to people who have been there, I've never heard anyone come back and say, well, yeah, it was kind of nice. It was good. Like everybody talks about it, like it is a life-changing experience to see Antarctica.
I think you've got it absolutely right. That is what sets Antarctica apart. You know, it has the ability to change your whole perspective. So yeah, you can see glaciers falling into the sea in Alaska or, you know, lots of places around the world. But it is something about the vastness and the ancient nature and the emptiness of humankind that you find in Antarctica. You know, the footprint of humans, the visible footprint of humans in Antarctica is still fairly light. You know, there's a scattering of research stations and historic buildings around the coast, a handful in the center of the continent. But, you know, this is a continent that's twice the size of Australia. And yet there's never been a native population. There is no one that can call themselves an Antarctican. There is no human culture there. There's no permanent infrastructure. And so when you find yourself, particularly, I think, in the central part of Antarctica, when you're getting that kind of straight, flat, white horizon that's 360 degrees all around you, and you know that you can walk it for 1,000 kilometers in any direction and the view will be exactly the same, just that flat white horizon. You get a sense of scale and a sense of perspective that very few other places on the planet can give you. And, you know, a lot of people, that means that they look inwards, you know, they look inside their own soul. Some people interpret that as a spiritual experience. They find that they get in touch with divinity. For others, like me, it just puts human beings, you know, our species into this perspective against the forces of nature that you're seeing all around you. Never mind everything that lies beyond that, you know, just compared to the forces of nature on our own planet, we're so tiny and puny and insignificant. And then you think about the universe beyond, and it's, you know, mind numbing almost trying to take all that in. And yet simultaneously, you're thinking that despite all that, despite how tiny and puny and insignificant we are, you know, here we are, not only surviving and thriving in Antarctica, a place that we were not designed to ever survive in, but we're understanding that environment. You know, we're finding ways to unpick the secrets of that extreme environment and, you know, creating technology that will enable us to understand it and hopefully in the future to protect it and all those sorts of things. So yeah, you come away from Antarctica with a whole new array of thoughts that perhaps you hadn't had before. And you'll find yourself reflecting on that long after you've left the coast of the continent and flown home. And, you know, it changes people's lives. People come back from a visit to Antarctica and they change their life, or they feel changed themselves, or they take a new direction, or they have a new perspective. All sorts of ways in which people interpret that experience. But like you say, no one ever comes back from that continent going, yeah, it was great, got some good photos. You know, that's
exactly
it changes you.
You mentioned quite a few different ways of basically gaining a deeper understanding. One way you mentioned it is gaining an actual deeper understanding about Antarctica. I just want to point out, you helped doing that as well, not just with your expeditions, but also with your research. Maybe we have a little bit of time later on to talk about it, but you actually spent quite a bit of time down there to research the ice and climate and so on. And you also talked about gaining an understanding about yourself and about how humans cannot only survive, but also thrive in these conditions. And these conditions are worth pointing out as well, I think. First of all, it's not only a flat plane that goes on and onto the horizon, right? There's also quite a bit of different height levels involved. And also, of course, there's the topic of temperature. So would you briefly go into that and explain a little bit about these conditions that you faced on your trip?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. A lot of people visualize Antarctica as being this sort of flat pancake at the bottom of the planet, but it's actually more of a dome in cross section. So around the coast, you're more or less at sea level. But then when you get to the interior regions, the Antarctic plateau that sits in the middle, there are parts of it that are over 4,000 meters or so. So, I mean, to put that into perspective, in world mountaineering terms, that's not much. That's less than half the height of Everest, for example. But it's still enough that you feel the effects of that altitude. It's very thin air and it's very cold temperatures when you're already in a very cold place. But the temperatures, you know, there's a lot of variation. So in summer, and increasingly as we see the impact of climate change and global warming, you know, you can experience temperatures that are above zero. And even when you're right down at minus 10 or minus 15, you know, the sun is so intense when you're down there in the summertime that, you know, you can sit around in shirt sleeves quite comfortably if there's no wind. And that's a huge surprise to a lot of people. But then, of course, you've got the other end of the scale. So when you're in the highest parts of Antarctica and there's a good wind blowing, you can be down below minus 40 degrees centigrade. And, you know, with some wind on top of that, you know, those are brutal temperatures. And that's in summertime. And then, of course, in winter, you can it can more than double below zero. So you can get down to minus 90 or so. And, you know, temperatures like that, that you can't even conceive of, you know, we have no idea what those sorts of temperatures would feel like. But they happen regularly in the wintertime.
It's hard for me to imagine, really. I mean, I've been to skiing and winter sports all my life, but I also recently moved to LA because I like good weather and the sunshine. So how did you deal with this cold? Did you get used to it after a few days or weeks? I mean, also inserting here, of course, you have already potentially gotten used to it because you know how to deal with it based just on your extended experience in the cold. But how is your relationship with that sensation and that condition? Does the sensation of cold ever change, or is it just that you by now just know, okay, I cannot expose any skin, I have to do these and these and these things to make sure I'm fine, but the challenges are basically more or less the same still?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, the coldest temperature that I know specifically I've ever experienced was minus 59 degrees centigrade. And that wasn't actually in Antarctica. That was in northeast Siberia. Mm-hmm. And the trouble with being in Antarctica is that, you know, I'm there on a ski expedition. I don't carry a thermometer with me. So I've got no idea what the temperature is most of the time. But I do have a good idea of the step change when you get down below sort of minus 40 degrees centigrade, which is exactly the same as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. That's where the two temperature scales meet. And, you know, it just different things start to happen when you get down below that temperature. It feels different. It's a whole new league of seriousness when you get down there. But, you know, so I've no idea what the coldest temperature is I've ever experienced in Antarctica. But quite often when I start talking about this, you know, I kind of get responses from people saying, oh, well, you know, I went snowboarding in Canada and it was minus 50 one day and, you know, that kind of thing. And I think what people fail to appreciate is that the problem with the cold in Antarctica is that it's relentless. There's no escape from it. Hmm. You know, it is there every second of every day that you are there. It is there. And, you know, when you experience minus five on a skiing holiday, you know, you only have to get down the bottom of the slope and there'll be a nice warm hut and some Glühwein or something waiting
for
you.
That's right. I can confirm that.
But, you know, in Antarctica, if you need to escape that cold, you've got to make yourself warm. You know, you've got to be proactive. There is nowhere to go and no one that's going to come rushing over that horizon to get you away from that cold. And when I'm taking teams to either the Arctic or the Antarctic, you know, we do a lot of training beforehand. And I think one of the biggest misgivings that I have to walk them through is this theory that, or this assumption that, oh, if I get all the right kit and if I know how to use it, then I won't feel cold anymore, that I'll feel nice and warm and comfortable. And that's just not the case. It doesn't matter how much experience you have. When you go into those kind of extreme conditions, you feel cold all the time. It's just that, you know, you keep yourself above that kind of critical cold level. You keep yourself comfortably cold. You know, it's about knowing when, okay, this is serious, I need to do something about it, and knowing what to do to warm yourself up or get yourself out of that predicament. And you know, and that can be hard. And I think the more you do it, the more susceptible you become to the cold too, in two ways. One is that you become a bit complacent. You know, the more you do it, the more the temptation is to think, oh, it'll be fine. You know, I know what I'm doing, so it will be fine. And, you know, sometimes you can get distracted or, you know, yeah, become complacent and then something happens. And the second thing is that I found certainly, and this has been backed up experientially by lots of people that I've worked with, is that either your circulation does seem to get worse the more time you spend in the cold. You know, I find I have to work a lot harder now to warm up my extremities than I did maybe 20 years ago. But then I'm sure someone is now going to say something really unkind, like, well, that's because you're getting older or something like that. That's usually the answer to these things.
Honestly, that was what I was thinking, but I already censored myself. I was not going to say it.
So yeah. You can leave me in happy ignorance that I just think that is the fault of the cold, not my age. Yeah.
You just mentioned in passing that the coldest temperature you ever witnessed and experienced was 59 degrees Celsius in Siberia. And I believe to remember that I also read about that. And the incredible thing there, of course, was you just described how relentless the cold is in Antarctica. What I found impressive about your experiences in Siberia is that people are actually living there, right? For them, it's part of the everyday life. It's not an expedition that they prepare for and that they have great equipment and they know they are doing something really extraordinary and somehow gain their motivation through that knowledge. But they just have to put up with it and go about whatever, their routines, their shopping, go to school, go to work, and endure these kind of temperatures.
Yes, and that was part of my motivation for spending time in Northeast Siberia in the depths of winter, in the coldest time, because, you know, I by then had a whole lifetime of spending time on polar expeditions where you have specialized equipment. And as you said earlier, you spend years preparing for these journeys and you have, you know, backup plans from A to Z. You have medical evacuation plans. You have search and rescue plans. You have, you know, just all this support and input into making sure that you can operate in those temperatures. And yet in this particular part of the world, it's called the Pole of Cold by the locals because it's the coldest inhabited place in the world. And, you know, you've got a small village there that people live there and they have children and they go to work and the kids go to school and they have cars and they have livestock. You know, the cows go to drink at the river every day. You know, so it was this whole topsy-turvy world. And not far away from the Pole of Cold is the city of Yakutsk, which is about 300,000 people. It feels like any European city, and yet the whole of the rules of physics seem to be suspended in this place. They don't seem to apply anymore. And you spend your whole time wandering around feeling like you've been Alice going down the, you know, through the looking glass or something like that. You're in some alternative universe. It's really strange. Lots of things are different because you're in temperatures between minus 40 and minus 50. So it was really wonderful not just to see the practicalities of how people live in those sorts of temperatures, but also to see how they view the cold. Do you dread winter coming when you know how brutal it's going to be? But in fact, we found, for example, winter is the time when people feel they can travel, that they can go to the next city or travel across country to see family and friends, because in wintertime, everything's frozen up and solid, and that makes travel very easy. Whereas in that part of the world, you know, in the summer thaw, travel suddenly becomes almost impossible. And I remember actually it wasn't in Siberia, but it was on the same trip. But as we returned, we were traveling overland and we came back through Arctic Norway. And there was a Sami woman that we met up in the top of northern Norway who told me, you know, people are always telling me that winter is the dark time. And she said, that's not how I see it. I see it as winter being the time of color. And, you know, I totally get what she means. I now live up near the Arctic Circle myself. And in winter, you have nights that are full of the aurora, where the sky is this blaze of color, and you have rivers and lakes that are frozen with ice, and you have this really low sun that only, you know, it sort of blends from sunrise into sunset. So you get skies that are full of yellows and pinks and all these wonderful colors all day long. It's just one great big long skyscape all day. So I now see what she means, that winter isn't the dark time, it's the time of color, which I thought was rather wonderful.
How was that for you in Antarctica on your Transarctic crossing? Did you, when spending so much time there on your own, with time learn to see additional details in the seemingly vast and empty landscape? As we pointed out before, you already knew that landscape, of course, but now you experience it in a completely new way. Was there a process that you learned to see even more details with regard to ice or snow formations, or even maybe there was some color somewhere beyond the white and the gray?
For sure. I mean, similarly with the Sami woman and winter, you know, people always telling me that Antarctica is a place of white. And yet I think of it as a place of light. The light there is astounding. Just the intensity of the sun, because you have a very thin atmosphere. You have no ozone layer, so you can get sunburn at the click of a fingers quite seriously, because you haven't got protection from the UV radiation coming from the sun. But the light is reflected through all of that snow, all of that ice. So everywhere you look, it's full of sparkle and rainbow. And then you get these wonderful optical effects in the sky. So things called halos, which is like a circular rainbow around the sun. And then parhelions or sun dogs, which are like bright patches in the sky. And you see these wonderful displays that are sort of halos on half halos, and they spread out. I mean, I once saw this ring going horizontally around the sky with five different fake suns, each of which had halos and half halos all the way around it. And it was just one of the most magical things I've ever seen in my life. And when you come back home and you try and explain, or even worse, write about those things, I remember quite clearly my editor, when I was writing the book, she came back to me with the whole section where I was trying to explain this wonderful optical illusion that I'd seen, saying, Felicity, what are you talking about? Like, you know, is this, are you imagining this, or is this in reality? You know, what is this that you're talking about? So I had to kind of tone it down, because she didn't believe that anyone reading the book would believe me. And then, of course, there's the things that are the true illusions that aren't actually there. You know, you start to hallucinate. So I had very strange hallucinations while I was in Antarctica. And the funny thing is that you don't just hallucinate with your visual sense, you hallucinate with all your senses. So you can hallucinate seeing things, mm-hmm. but you can also hallucinate sounds, mm-hmm. you can hallucinate smells, you can hallucinate tastes. So, you know, seeing visual hallucinations was bizarre, and, you know, you have to get used to it. But I think perhaps more annoying is when all day long you can smell freshly baked bread or something, you know, and then that's, of course, the only thing you can think about is how much you are craving some freshly baked bread mm-hmm. with melted butter on top. And you can imagine when you're on an expedition, that can be really maddening to be able to smell and taste those things that you can't have.
Let's talk a little bit about the practicalities of the trip. You mentioned before that you were moving along on skis. Talk a little bit more about how you managed to move around there, and what your equipment and the overall concept of that expedition looked like.
Yeah, so obviously when you go out on a trip, you want to have the best equipment that mm-hmm. you possibly can. But, you know, best is very individual. You know, what's best for me may not be best for someone else. So it's a tricky thing, because you seek opinions from all sorts of experts and veterans and people you trust, and then you read books about what other people have done, and it can drive you round and round in circles. And so eventually you just have to go with your gut. And for me, it was a combination of wanting to be as lightweight as I possibly could, while also having the best that I possibly could. But also, you know, it sounds mundane, but it's important what I could afford. You know, these trips are incredibly expensive to put together, so there's never enough money to go around. And so, for example, I had wonderful skis. Had Asnes Amundsen sort of Nordic backcountry skis. But then I was attached to a sledge, which was just a lightweight, relatively budget, made out of a reinforced plastic sledge. I couldn't afford one of the really big ones, so I had two of the smaller ones that were attached one behind the other. So that was my system. And I got a friend at the time to make for me a special carbon fiber linking between the two sledges so that they wouldn't roll. That's what I was worried about, you know, if you have two in series. And there's nothing worse than having a sledge that rolls over on every lump or bump in the snow surface. You know, if you have to go back to right your sledge a dozen times in the last 10 minutes, you know, that can drive you insane too. So, and then, you know, everything else, it was really about keeping it as basic as possible. You know, I didn't want to have to carry spares or huge repair kits. So it was about getting equipment that was as simplistic as it possibly could be, you know, no complicated working parts, and also kit that I knew inside out and back to front. So my stoves, for example, I travel with MSR XGK stoves, and, you know, those stoves I have taken apart to all their constituent bits as far, you know, as tiny as I could get them, and put them back again. And I could do that in the dark without even looking. And, you know, even just by hearing those stoves, I know what's about to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And how to fix it. And so it's kind of reaching that point with all of your kits that you know it to that depth. But, you know, with those stoves, there's hardly any working parts that can malfunction. And similarly with the bindings on my skis, they were metal, you know, just 3-pin bindings. So there's really very little that can go wrong with that, you know, unless you have something really catastrophic going wrong. So that your repair kit is pretty much a bundle of gaffer tape and a few tubes of super glue, and, you know, that's, and your ingenuity, and that's what you're relying on.
Okay, and all of this, even though you tried to keep it quite minimalist, of course, it was still a lot of equipment and you had to pull it all these days and weeks and months. How big was the physical challenge for you in the end?
Yeah, so when I started, I got the weight in those sledges collectively mm-hmm. down to 85 kilograms. Mm-hmm. And I weighed a bit less than that at the time. I weighed about 80 kilograms, something like that. So I felt quite good about that starting weight. But I wasn't completely unsupported. So I, you know, the bulk of that weight, of that 85 kilograms, was food and fuel. And so I had 25 kilograms of food and fuel in a depot at the South Pole, and then a further 15 kilograms of food and fuel to pick up about 500 kilometers further along my projected course. And they'd been left for me on the snow by the plane that had dropped me off at the beginning of my route. But it's one of the things, I don't have many regrets, but maybe a nagging little thing is now in the back of my mind thinking, I reckon, you know, if I'd added that extra 40 kilograms, what impact would that have had on the outcome of my journey? And it would have been quite nice, you know, just for the simplicity and the purity of it, to have had everything in my sledge right from the beginning. So,
and to do it completely unsupported. Yeah,
yeah, that would have been quite nice mm-hmm. to have done that, just from a personal point of view. But at the time, I didn't know. And, you know, there were times in that journey where I really struggled, like getting up the glacier right at the beginning of my journey, coming up through the Transantarctic Mountains. It was really wind scoured. So I had these sort of katabatic winds coming down the glacier towards me that were absolutely furious. And there was no purchase. You know, there were large areas of that glacier that had been completely polished by those winds. And so there's me in my ski boots. I'd taken off my skis, long since forgot about trying to get up there with skis on. So I'm in my ski boots and I was literally doing, you know, two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back. So maybe having an extra 40 kilograms in my sledges would have made that more difficult. And then the end of the season is pretty abrupt in Antarctica. You know, all the planes leave on a certain date in January, and that's it. You know, if you're not where the planes are by that date, they will come and get you and make sure you are on those planes. So mm-hmm. I remember the last plane out in 2012 was the 26th of January. And I finished, I think it was on the 23rd of January. Wow. Okay. So I cut it pretty fine. Yeah. So maybe that extra 40 kilograms would have slowed me down enough that on the 23rd of January, they would have been coming to pick me up maybe 100 kilometers from the end of my journey or something like that. And I can't even begin to imagine how frustrating, what a bigger regret that yeah. would be potentially than being unsupported. Yeah, I'm happy with the way that I did that expedition. I'm very proud of it. And and for me personally, I enjoyed every second in a perverse kind of way. I didn't enjoy it at the time, but I enjoy it in retrospect.
That's often the thing with good memories and challenges, right? They turn better with time, like a good bottle of wine. So that's the physical side of things. But we also earlier on hinted at the mental side of things, the knowledge or the conscious decision to find out more about how you deal in terms of discipline and so on with this kind of a solitude. Do you remember when the first moment arose when you realized that this kind of solitude was actually going to be a big challenge for you?
Yeah, the first seconds of the expedition. And okay. I often get asked, you know, what was the hardest part? And it was that those first few seconds. I remember very clearly standing on the Ross Ice Shelf at the very beginning of my journey, watching the plane that had just sort of dropped me out the back. I mean, you know, they keep one engine going. So you get out one side, the other engine's still going. The pilots help you out with your sledges, shake your hands, and then they're out of there because they want to get back closer to base as quick as possible. And I just remember watching that plane disappear and then contemplating the view around me. And that sense of isolation just rushed in and it was crushing. It was like I was hit by a truck. And, you know, I didn't go there without the expectation that I would feel alone. You know, I deliberately sought out advice from people who had been solo before, from sports psychologists that specialize in aspects of aloneness. They taught me tools and techniques to use. You know, my mind was full of all these things that I'd prepared. And yet in that first second of realization, I realized just how ill prepared I was. You know, it wasn't anything like I thought it was going to be. And I found that I had to start from scratch in terms of finding a coping mechanism.
And you had to do that fast, right? I mean, you didn't have days and weeks to find a coping mechanism. I mean, to a certain extent you did because you were alone for days and weeks, but you also had to pull yourself together more or less immediately as well.
I think more, it was a gradual, I mean, it never stayed the same from day to day. You know, that was something that I had to learn as well, was that, you know, you think you've come up with a coping strategy that works, and then you find that a week later, that doesn't work for you anymore. You know, things have changed, things have moved on. And so it was very much, you know, letting go of that expectation that I would find the silver bullet that would make it all okay. There was nothing that was going to make this all okay, apart from finishing and going home. And, you know, it was about just finding what worked in that particular moment for that particular set of circumstances. And it really varied. I mean, to start off with, I'm talking immediately, almost before the plane left, started talking aloud to myself. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think it was probably after about a month, I suddenly realized I'm not talking at all anymore. You know, I wasn't talking aloud at all. It had all moved to sort of an internal monologue in my head. And then a bit later on, it was quite close to the end, maybe a few weeks before I finished, although I didn't realize that at the time. So 6 weeks into the journey, I remember stopping skiing to pitch up my tent at the end of one ski day and thinking, what have I thought about all day? And I couldn't remember one single thought that had passed through my mind. Nothing. It was as if I'd entered some extreme meditative state. And, you know, and if you think about it, you know, it's so rhythmic, cross-country skiing. It's slide, slide, tap, tap, breathe, slide, slide, tap, tap, breathe. And you're breathing in and you're breathing out. And it's all the things that you do when you're taught how to meditate, really. You know, I wasn't asleep. I didn't have my eyes closed, but my brain was in some kind of holding pattern. It was just easier that way. But interestingly, that scared me. You know, that realization that my mind had been totally empty, that sort of made the hairs on the back of my neck rise, because I was worried about what impact this experience might have on me and my mental state. I was slightly worried, not helped by the fact that a very good friend of mine, who's an absolute, you know, rock of the expedition world, very experienced. Yeah, everyone that's been on an expedition has been through her office at some point or other. And when I told her that I was going alone across Antarctica, she said to me, oh no, Felicity, don't. You know, everyone that goes out there alone, they always come back changed and rarely for the better. Mm. And her words came back to me so often during that journey. I thought, oh God, I don't want to come home as some kind of, you know, one of those eccentric people that have been out in the world too long. You know, I was really worried about that, but hopefully turned out not to be the case. At least no one has had the guts to admit to me that it has been the case.
I have the feeling you are not too eccentric so far. Was that these doubts and so on, was that around the time you also posted that tweet that I mentioned in the beginning, when you wrote that in addition to your toes and your brain and so on, even your thoughts ache? Or was that a different kind of phase of the expedition?
No, I mean, that was certainly written right in the midst of all of that, because you get to a point where monotony and boredom and an empty mind feel like this abyss that is just on the periphery of your vision, that you're always in danger of falling into this abyss. And, you know, you're not sure what the impact of that would be, what the consequences of that would be. So you're trying to stay out of this abyss the whole time. You know, you're trying to keep your mind busy. You're trying to keep your mind on track. You're trying to do all the things that you've been taught to do before you've gone there. And, you know, the effort of all of that is enormous. It's like you're always trying to second guess your own brain. And I found that enormously scary as well as hard work. I mean, for example, when you're on a team expedition, like I mentioned before, you know, largely you don't have a choice but to be self-disciplined, to do the right thing, to do what you're supposed to do, to play your part, to do your role, because there's people immediately there to observe what you're doing and to, you know, give you an elbow in the ribs if you're not doing it. But when you're on your own, there's this constant devil on your shoulder that's saying, you know, you could set up your tent now and get some extra sleep. Who's going to know? You can tell everyone it was bad weather today and just have a day off. Who would know? You can eat all that chocolate that you've got rationed. You know, who's going to know? Eat all your rations now. Why not? You know, 100 million things, like every second of every moment, this devil on your shoulder is saying all these different things that you can do. Why not? Same with expressing emotion. You know, I found that whereas normally, like most people in society, if I'm feeling an emotion, I'll wait for an appropriate time and an appropriate way in which to express that emotion. But when there's no one around to observe you, suddenly, you know, if you're happy, you're euphoric. If you're upset about something, you're bawling your eyes out into your goggles. If you're angry, you're throwing your ski poles in the snow and yelling at the sky in frustration. And you find that you switch between those emotions at the click of your fingers. And suddenly you feel like you are losing your mind. You know, you're losing control. And it's really scary. It's really a frightening place to find yourself. So I certainly returned home with a renewed appreciation of what it means to have good mental health and how we should not put that at risk, perhaps as much as we do.
You like to open your speeches with a question to the audience, which is, when was the last time you were really alone? Do you have the feeling that this kind of solitude you experienced in Antarctica can be experienced at all in our normal lives and civilization and everyday life? What feedback are you getting on that question?
I mean, since it's been a decade now since I completed that expedition. And as you can imagine, I've spent a lot of that time discussing isolation and what it means to be alone in various aspects. And I've had so much interesting feedback. And what's come across is that, you know, being alone can mean, you know, people can feel absolutely isolated when they're surrounded by others. I remember a musician, a soloist, who talked to me about the moments waiting in the wings before she went on stage to give her performance and how she was overwhelmed by the feeling that nobody could help her. You know, nobody could come to her rescue. It was all on her. She was absolutely responsible for that. And then someone who was suffering from awful depression, talking about standing by their front door and forcing themselves to walk through that front door at the beginning of a day and how alone they felt with the weight of that challenge. And then people that have been in positions of seniority, you know, management positions, as they say, it's lonely at the top, but, you know, talking about having to make really crucial decisions that will tangibly impact on the lives of so many. And in the moment of having to make that decision, that it doesn't matter who you're surrounded by, you feel incredibly lonely in that moment. And then, of course, over the last 2 years, we've all felt to an extent what it means to be severed from those human connections. And I think it's made us all realize that us human beings, we're born to be social animals. It's in our DNA that we're surrounded by a tribe. And when suddenly you're not in that society, that community, that tribe anymore, that really starts us fraying at the edges. And it is a very different scenario.
Do you feel like in these past 2 years, COVID and so on, was it at all helpful to you that you experienced real physical loneliness like that to now be able to deal with? I don't know if you were lonely, probably you had your family around you, but of course the social life of all of us have been impacted and changed. Was that something that you could draw on in these 2 years, or is that too far, too much interpretation?
No, for sure. I mean, you know, in a very practical way, and then in a more sort of emotional way, it helped on various levels. I mean, on the practical level, you know, I mean, it sounds very boring, but the importance of routine, that was so clear to me from the beginning of the first lockdown that that I was affected by. It was that you have to keep a routine. You have to get up every day and put on clothes and put on some makeup and, you know, have some kind, you know, eat breakfast at breakfast time and dinner at dinner time, because I'd seen on my expeditions that, you know, if you let that routine slip very quickly, you lose track of time, and that then affects your emotions and your ability to continue. So routine was very important right from the beginning. I also knew that checking in with myself and keeping a record of that was very important. It's something that I now do as a matter of course. I just give myself like a score out of 10 every day on how I'm feeling. And the reason I do that is because the brain is very fickle and it always tends towards the worst. So if you're feeling a bit down, or, you know, you're feeling like everything's going wrong, the tendency is to think, oh, this has been going on forever. You know, I've been feeling down for weeks and weeks and weeks. But if you've actually made a note of how you're feeling, you'll look back and you'll think, oh, only 4 days ago, I gave myself, you know, an 8 out of 10 for optimism or something, you know. And so you'll see that actually it wasn't that long ago that things were kind of going all right. And so I found that that was quite important as well. I mean, it's not a daily record I make anymore because things take over, but, you know, just having some kind of record of how you're doing and taking the time just to check in with yourself on a regular basis and get some perspective, you know, because when you're so involved in the day-to-day disasters and catastrophes that, you know, modern life is full of, it can make you feel really down and lose perspective on the fact of how far we have gone. Yeah. You know, if you just look over the last 2 years, yes, it was awful and tragic and devastating, but then, you know, there was so much wonder and brilliance and fantastic inventiveness that came out of all of that. And that's exactly what I see on expeditions. You know, it reinforces my faith in the human spirit, because occasionally you'll see someone that it will reveal something not very nice in them. But most of the time, what's revealed on expedition, when people are really at their most raw, when they're feeling vulnerable and scared and cold and tired and far from home and all of those things, what you see is human beings being brilliant. I mean, being kind and compassionate and inventive and strokes of leadership brilliance and selflessness. And it just reminds you that, you know, we are incredible creatures that are capable of amazing things. So I think we need to remember that in times of adversity more than ever.
Maybe you are just very good at picking your team members.
But sometimes I don't get to pick them. I've worked as a, you know, as a jobbing guide as well, where you don't get to pick your team members. And yeah, there's been one or two exceptions to the rule, but in the most part, you know, people have been pretty amazing.
Just a quick technical question. We mentioned this tweet. And how far did you have contact with the outside world? We talked so much about being alone, like just to give some context with that regard. Did you just send out a tweet here and there? Or did you have, some kind of communication with your team at home?
Yeah, well, I have a confession to make. Yes. It looked like I was tweeting, but I wasn't actually. So what I had was I had a satellite phone, because you're obliged under the permissions that you need to have to make journeys in Antarctica. You're obliged to carry a satellite phone now. And with that satellite phone, I had to make one call a day to the logistical hub in order to report my position and to report that I was safe and well. The idea being that if in any 24-hour period they didn't hear from me, they would go back to my last known position to start looking for me. So it was a safety. I mean, it was a safety net with large holes in it, but it was a safety net. So I had to make this call once a day. And there's a couple of things interesting about that. The first is that I could have used that satellite phone to ring anybody I wanted at any time, but I chose not, even though I was having such a tough time of it mentally. And I think the problem was, is that, you know, I could ring my best mate or I could ring my mum. But, you know, then I would have to press disconnect and they would be gone again. You know, so I was worried, I guess, about the turbulence that would cause in an already quite fragile mental state of coping, to have that real high followed by such a low. I was scared of that. And then the second thing that was interesting was that one daily call at the beginning of the journey, the radio operator at the other end that would answer that call every day, to start off with, they were deliberately quite chatty and cheery. They were aware that I was on my own and that they were the only person that I would speak to in any 24 hours. And so they would, you know, tell me gossip from what was going on around the camp. But I found that I couldn't tolerate it. And to the point, very quickly, maybe within a week or so, that call became just a straight transfer of conversation. I would say, hi, this is Felicity. This is my position. I'm safe and well. Bye. And cut the phone off. You know, and I felt really rude. I mean, after the expedition, I deliberately apologized to the radio operator. I went to seek him out and said, you know, I'm so sorry. I wasn't being rude. I just could not cope with...
He probably thought, okay, there's another person who goes eccentric after 1 or 2 weeks already.
Maybe I get the impression they've probably seen it all before. Yeah. People go, you know, one way or the other, one extreme or another. But I found that I just couldn't. And, you know, and I've seen that through COVID as well, that I think, you know, during lockdown, a lot of people became quite brittle, even when you're talking to them over Zoom or something like that, and didn't perhaps realize how inaccessible they were making themselves and how sort of shut down they had become. So it can be really difficult when you're in the middle of that isolation to allow other people in, even if they're trying to reach you with the best intentions. You know, it can be difficult to let them in. I certainly found that I was of the type that built a kind of bubble around myself and didn't want anything to disturb that very fragile bubble.
When did you realize that you would soon have made it?
I know exactly when that was. That was on day 56 of my journey. So I've been skiing for 56 days. And it was a bit of a whiteout, but not too bad. And up ahead, I just saw these sort of grey blobs. And by then, I was used to seeing sort of grey blobs appearing and disappearing and doing all sorts of things. So I didn't pay much attention at first. But it was the next morning when I got out of my tent and I noticed that those grey blobs were still on the horizon. And then I realized what they were. They were the Ellsworth Mountains, which mark the coast of the Ronnie Ice Shelf, where I'd planned to finish my journey. And, you know, it's no exaggeration that before that point, I really hadn't allowed myself to dwell on the thought of finishing or succeeding or anything like that. You know, that was thinking too far ahead. But the moment I saw those mountains, they were still a good 100 kilometers or more away. The visibility in Antarctica is really quite astounding. But once I saw those mountains, that's when I allowed myself to dare to dream that I would finish the journey. But of course, I was still worried about running out of time. Remember, I was really hard up against that deadline when that plane was going. So, but I did make it in the end, and that was pretty wonderful.
And you said in an interview it was the ultimate anti-climax at the end. Why did you think like that?
Yeah, because I sort of finished. So I looked down at my GPS, and it told me that I was now on ice over water. So I was on the Ronnie Ice Shelf. I wasn't on the landmass anymore. That meant I'd finished my journey. But I think I must have continued for, I don't know, another 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 nautical miles. Well, maybe not that much, maybe 10 kilometers maximum before I stopped, because it just felt too, you know, I couldn't quite compute that I had finished, you know, for all of that time, for 2 months, it had all been about keeping moving forward, keeping onwards, keeping progressing. And now I didn't have to do that anymore. And I sort of sat down on my sledge. And I remember I pulled out my camera and took one of the only videos that I took on the entire journey. Incredible now, 10 years later, to think that I didn't make any videos on my journey, but I didn't. So I pulled out my camera and I made this video, and I often play it at the end of my talks because I think it just says in more ways than I can describe about the physical and mental exhaustion of that moment. You know, you can just tell by the way I'm talking that I can't quite mentally grasp the fact that I've done it and that I'm on my way home. So there it is. Hercules Inlet and the Ronnie Ice Shelf. The opposite side of Antarctica to the Ross Ice Shelf where I started. I got here about 20 minutes ago. I've just been sitting here ever since. I don't really know what I was expecting. Don't really know what it all after counting the days and the miles for so long. It all seems to have come to an end a bit quick. And now here I am. 1700 kilometers, 14 and a half degrees, 59 days later. I don't think I know yet what it all means or how I feel about it.
And of course, I'm pleased to be here, but right now I just feel really shell-shocked that it's over. That I'm done. That I'm on my way home. And the only thing I can think that I want right now is to ring my mom and to let her know that I'm here. No, I'm okay, because I don't have to go anywhere now. The plane comes to me. I can't believe it. I can't believe that I've skied across Antarctica. It's just too ridiculous. It's just far too silly.
There was relief in there. There was disbelief in there. But what there wasn't was sort of pride or achievement or anything like that, or celebration or triumph. It turns out those are things that you really need other people to be around in order to feel those things. Those are emotions that bounce off of others. You know, you can't really celebrate something like that on your own. You know, you need other people there. So it wasn't until a long time afterwards that I registered my first moment of pride or achievement. You know, I remember when it was when I went along to the Guinness Book of World Records and they gave me my certificate. And I just got this kick of, actually, I did do that. You know, that is actually what I did. I
Pretty
went from
amazing.
One side to the other. And and they sort of had this big map of Antarctica pinned on the wall, like a world map with Antarctica in the middle. Yeah. And I thought, I crossed that on my skis by myself. I did that. Yeah.
Must have been a really good feeling. Okay, so appreciating that to its full extent took a while. How long did it take for you to be able to switch between these extremely different worlds in terms of your routines out there and back home, and also the social interactions? How long did it take you to realize you luckily, happily didn't turn into an eccentric weirdo or outsider?
Yeah, well, I mean, it varied. So, I mean, I remember being in the base camp. So the plane came back after about 24 hours. The plane was able to come back and pick me up and take me to the main base camp where all the planes leave Antarctica. And I remember standing around talking to some people, and I needed the toilet. I needed to go to the toilet. And so my instinct, you know, mid-sentence, was just to reach round to the back of my trousers to pee on the spot. Luckily, you know, I kind of froze and realized, oh, no, I need to go and find the appropriate place now, the appropriate facility for that. So there was kind of, you know, that level of social etiquette, which came back very quickly. But when I got back to the UK, it very much felt like I was going through the motions. Mm-hmm. But that the real me was actually in a sort of huddle in the back of my head somewhere, just slowly processing what had just happened and what I had experienced. And it took a long while. I mean, you know, I'm thinking maybe 4 to 6 months before I first felt that those two parts of me had come back together and that I felt fully present in the moment as I do now. So that was a long time. And interestingly, sort of the physical recovery kind of mirrored that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when I first came back, I was super fit, the fittest I've ever been in my life. I had just done really low intensity, hard work at altitude for a long period of time. So I was super fit. I could run upstairs and not even think about being out of breath. It was brilliant. But unfortunately, it didn't last very long. So that quickly wore off. But it gave me the effect of sort of overtraining. You know, mm-hmm. if you've ever done too much in the gym and pushed it too far. And so, yes, you're super fit, but you're kind of super fragile as well. You feel like the slightest bump will cause you an injury. You feel brittle almost. And I very much felt like that. So it took a long time, perhaps longer, maybe as much as a year, before I felt sort of physically recovered from that.
When you think back to all of that today, a decade later, is it possible for you to pinpoint which aspects of this journey stayed with you the most? Is it the confidence that you can manage being alone? Is it knowing that you are a very disciplined person? Is it something else?
Yeah, it's tough because I think, again, you know, just like The coping strategies I use as I went across Antarctica were never the same from day to day. I think the way you reflect on an experience and what you draw from an experience in your past changes depending on the experiences that you have as you go through life. For me, I became a parent 4 years ago, and suddenly the confidence I felt, or proving myself to others, or things that had been maybe important to me in my past suddenly didn't matter a fig. And you've got a whole new set of priorities. And for example, someone said to my little boy who's four the other day, oh, they were looking at a map of Antarctica and they're like, your mummy crossed this on her skis. And he just looked at them like, it was the most boring thing he'd ever heard in his life, really.
Impressed.
Yeah. And so, when you start to think about, okay, what do I want to reflect on at the end of my life? What do I want to leave behind? What are the things that I want to leave behind for my children? And what's the legacy I want to leave? Those kind of things. It's amazing how something like this, which felt so momentous at the time, just becomes one aspect of a whole life lived, Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure how to answer that question, in all honesty.
That's fine, and that is something I would also like to point out. We have talked about that one expedition in detail right now because it is the one that you are most well known for, but you did so much more in your life with regard to Antarctica and also other destinations and kinds of projects. And if you wouldn't mind, I would be more than happy to talk about all of that as well in another interview. But for now, I would like to thank you for sharing these amazing experiences and insights with us. It was a pleasure for me to talk to you about it. Thank you so much for it.
Thank you. It's been really good fun.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Das war Felicity Aston und ihre Erzählung über ihre Durchquerung oder Überquerung der Antarktis. Und wie ich am Ende des Gespräches auch schon angedroht habe, ich werde mich in den nächsten Monaten bemühen, gemeinsam mit Felicity einen weiteren Termin zu finden für ein weiteres Gespräch. Und dann werden wir uns über ihre vielen, vielen anderen Projekte unterhalten, die sie neben dieser berühmtesten ihrer Expedition sonst noch so durchgeführt hat. Und die sind wirklich definitiv ein weiteres Gespräch wert. Ihr dürft euch darauf freuen. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal. Euer Erik, ciao.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.